Thank you. Be seated.
For counsel's benefit, Justice Gammons is recused on a second cause, and in this cause, Justice Spector is recused. The remaining justices of the court will consider all of these causes. We are now ready to hear oral argument and petitions. The Public Utility Commission of Texas and others versus GTE Southwest Incorporated and others.
May it please the court, Mr. Steve Barron and Mr. W. Chop McCullough will present argument for the petition. Petitioners have reserved 9 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Barron will open with the first statement.
May it please the court, today you have heard cases in which the major public utilities in this state have come to this court urging that the Commission's fundamental duty to ensure just and reasonable rates under Section 39A of the Public Utility Regulatory Act must mean, necessarily implies, that the Commission has the flexibility and discretion under the statute to address unreasonable or extraordinary periods of regulatory lag through use of deferred time. In this case, consumer groups, the Office of Public Utility Counsel and the General Services Commission, come to this court urging that the Commission's fundamental duty to ensure just and reasonable rates must mean, necessarily implies, that the Commission has the flexibility and discretion to set an effective date for its rate orders that addresses the unreasonable effects of regulatory lag. The Commission says that they are both right, and it is not just the source of the Commission's implied authority to ensure just and reasonable rates through the use of setting an effective date for its rate orders, comes not just from the core provision in Section 39A of PURA. That is one core provision. On your handout that you have been provided today, the first page you will see lists several provisions which provide the source for the Commission's authority in this case. Section 2 and Sections 18A state the basic purpose of the Act to assure that rates are just and reasonable to the consumers and to the utilities. Section 16A of PURA grants to the Commission the power to do all things, whether specifically designated or implied, necessary and convenient to the exercise of its power and jurisdiction. Section 38 expressly states that it shall be the duty of the Public Utility Commission to ensure that every rate charged is just and reasonable and non-discriminatory. The crux of this case is whether that broad delegation of authority is undone, as the Court of Appeals found, by the language in Sections 42 and 43F of PURA, which appear on page 2 of your handout. The focus of the Court of Appeals and of GTE has been that the language, the rates shall thereafter, are thereafter to be observed until thereafter to be observed until change, acts as an absolute bar on the Commission's exercise of discretion in setting a rate, the effective date for its rate order to address unreasonable regulatory lag. The Commission, in this case, examined those provisions, and it reasonably concluded that this language, read in context, should be considered to be a procedural compliance provision. These provisions state that after a hearing has been held, the Commission shall determine or fix the rates. It shall put that determination in the form of an order. It shall serve it on the public utility, and the rates thereafter shall be observed. The Commission reasonably concluded, consistent with the plain language of the statute, that this is a procedural compliance statute. Once the order is served, you shall thereafter do what the order tells you to do. It does not act as an absolute bar. Now, I'm not here today to say that the Court of Appeals reading is implausible, that one couldn't literally read the thereafter language to act as an absolute bar. But the Commission's interpretation, if it is reasonable, and if it does not contradict the plain language of the statute, is entitled to be respected by the courts. This court has held so as recently as January of this year in Tarrant Appraisal District versus Moore at 845 Southwest 2nd, 820.
Are you saying that the PUC could go either way?
Your Honor?
Are you saying the PUC could reach either conclusion and both would be within its discretion?
Either conclusion as to, you mean defer to? You could.
As to the retroactivity of its order?
It has the discretion to decide.
So it can decide in a given case that it can be backdated, or it could decide in a similar case that it would not backdate.
Yes, Your Honor. And it is important to understand, I think, both with respect to both regulatory tools, that these tools, deferred accounting and setting an effective date that's retroactive, works both ways. One is not an entirely pro-utility, and the other entirely consumer-oriented provision. In a rate increase case, which this is not, the commission could reasonably determine to the benefit of the utility that an extraordinary long time to conduct the rate case, in this case it was 5 years, would be a good case in which to apply, make the rate, reduce the period of regulatory lag by setting a rate order. And similarly, the effective date of its rate order essentially retroactively back to what was in this case the midpoint of the regulatory lag period.
As a practical matter, they could set a retroactive rate increase?
In a case, that case was indeed before you in Railroad Commission versus Lone Star, Your Honor, where the utility came and argued that indeed the Railroad Commission had no discretion whatsoever and had to backdate its rate order to the date that the rate case was first filed. And this court held that no, the commission has discretion. The discretion is not unbridled. And indeed, the commission doesn't claim that its discretion is unbridled in this instance. Apart from the factors that ought to be considered in the exercise of this discretion is the question of the constitutional constraints. And there was an element in Mr. Reisner's comments in the WTU case suggesting that going back and second-guessing would be unfair and indeed would impair vested property rights or the vested right of the utility to come forward and charge the legal rate from the last order. The commission states that the analysis on the constitutional issue is properly set forth in the Texaltel case. Once the utility has been given fair notice on the filing of a rate case that its rates are reasonably subject to change, then indeed all bets are off. And the question of fair notice is met, and reasonable expectations are met.
And Mr. Barron,
that's reflected in the last page of your handout.
Now, the commission can set interim rates, right, or can it?
Your Honor, there is no express statutory authority in a rate decrease case, which is essentially what this was, Section 42. This court has held in City of Corpus Christi versus Public Utility Commission at 572 Southwest 2nd that it is patently necessary, looking at Section 16A, one of the general provisions, it is patently necessary and convenient to the Commission's exercise of jurisdiction to set temporary rates. And they found that implied power here. There are none in Section 42.
Is this a case where temporary rates were set?
This is a case, Your Honor, in which the Commission tried to set temporary rates, and they were blocked from doing so because the utility came forward to district court and obtained a letter ruling from the judge.
Well, I'm
preventing that.
Familiar with that, but is this a case, but there is statutory authority for the commission to set interim rates?
Only in the rate increase context.
Well, you moved ahead of me. The statute only permits interim rate increases for certain circumstances.
Yes.
Isn't the effect of what the PUC did was to establish an interim rate and do indirectly what the statute does not permit it to do directly?
Well, I think that if you begin from the proposition, which I accept in the City of Corpus Christi case, that the Commission has the implied power to set temporary rates, and if you look at the provision, at the third page, where the General Counsel files its answer in this case, saying that indeed we believe that the existing rates may well not be just and reasonable. That, it seems to me, puts everyone on notice and is tantamount to saying that your rates from this point forward are, in essence, temporary. And I think that concept is recognized in the City of Corpus Christi case. It's expressly recognized in the Texaltel case, 798 Southwest 2nd. The idea that once the case is filed, utility and all parties are on fair notice that there are no more vested rights, and I think that is a permissible way for the court, for the commission to proceed. Thank you.
A couple of questions. Were the court to determine that the deferred accounting treatment discussed in the last two cases was not something that the commission had statutory power to do, would that necessarily determine the outcome of this case?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. Not in its entirety, because it seems to me that the two remedies are not, while there is some overlap, are not entirely, do not overlap entirely. I do think that, of course, you have Section 42 and 43F to construe in this instance. And in the other case, you have not only Section 39A, but also Section 27, which gives the Commission power to prescribe accounting forms. So it could turn on a different statutory interpretation. But I think the basic proposition really is there, that the Commission needs to have, as a matter of its implied power, the opportunity to address extraordinary instances of regulatory lag to ensure just and reasonable.
In these earlier cases, I suppose it's been implied, if not expressed, that all of the regulatory lag was something that worked adversely to the utility in those cases. Was there a finding in this case that General Telephone contributed to the regulatory lag by the tactics that it employed?
Yes, Your Honor. It was an amended finding of fact 11, in which the Commission found that GTE Southwest had engaged in dilatory tactics that contributed in part, and this was part of the Commission basis for the Commission's finding, contributed in part to the extraordinary amount of regulatory delay in this instance. I don't think that that is necessarily dispositive of the issue here, because I think the Commission under the statute ought to be able to say, for whatever reason, when you have a case in which it's been found that the utility has been over-earning by $59 million annually, and this case, for whatever reason, has taken 5 years, that the Commission can reasonably exercise its discretion for the benefit of ratepayers and set the effective date at a midpoint in the period.
Mr. Brennan, as you sit down, you are saying that the Commission has the authority to set rates retroactively, or what are we saying about retroactive rates?
Well, we are saying that the Commission has the statutory authority, and it is not impermissibly prescribed by the Constitution, to set a retroactive effective date, provided that it comes sometime after
the filing period.
The filing period.
And now the state has also taken the position that to allow some interim construction costs is, as deferral, is retroactive rate setting. But you're saying the state's position is, as long as that all occurs after the filing period, then that's not retroactive. So that's okay.
You speak too broadly when you speak of the state, because this is the Public Utility Commission that is taking the position that indeed there is no retroactive problem either with deferred accounting or with the
extending
retroactive
effect.
I hope the co-counsel
will
have an opportunity to provide this
form. Now, at this point, are you all adverse to any extent, or is the Attorney General on the same side of this case?
We end up at the same place, but we get there using different roads.
All right, the court will allow 4 minutes.
What the Commission did in the GTE case is essentially deferred accounting. The difference is that in GTE, the Commission was exercising express rate-making authority, and the retroactive relief that it granted was during the time period over which it had rate-making jurisdiction. That is why, in response to a prior question this morning, I indicated that I didn't necessarily have a problem with what the Commission did in the deferred accounting cases, but with the scope of the relief in terms of the time and the amounts that were granted. Let me also indicate in that response I was not indicating concurrence on the 41A issue. That's a separate question. And note that in the GTE case, the Commission did not order interest or the reverse of a return for the retroactive, for the regulatory lag period in issue in GTE. Now, deferred accounting is just what the accountants call what happened in the electric cases. The same practical effect was reached in GTE by relating back the effective date of the rate period. I would say if you can't relate back the effective date of a rate order, you certainly can't do deferred accounting. But if you allow deferred accounting, then I promise you what we are going to do, if you affirm the Court of Appeals in GTE, we're going to go back on remand and say, do deferred accounting for GTE. We agree, Justice Doggett, But in an appropriate case, yes, the commission can relate back the effective date of an increase in rates in an appropriate case. If the commission pays attention to the various policy guidelines that I tried to lay out for you earlier this morning. And let me just discuss very briefly how GTE, the decision in GTE, compares to those policy guidelines. One, the commission had complete cost of service information. It established a revenue requirement and then just moved that back in time. Two, the commission had rate-making jurisdiction over the entire period. Three, the company was told that this might happen in the second order of remand. And, oh, by the way, in January of 1989, the commission also entered an order establishing temporary rates. There was no other remedy that the commission had in a rate reduction case, because you can't bond reductions. We had attempted temporary rates and were frustrated at the district court. What the commission did was balanced in that the commission did not attach for the ratepayers all of the so-called over-collections. Income taxes were reduced in 1986, but we only went back to 1987. The gross receipts tax reduction was implemented in October of 85, but we only went to 87. So the commission didn't go back all the way to the date of the cost change, or even to when jurisdiction attached. It was much more balanced than what happened in the deferred accounting cases. What is the problem with the Court of Appeals results in these two cases? In the GTE case, thereafter means thereafter. Unknown cost changes cannot be retroactively addressed by the commission. 1983 amendments to the Gas Act to protect the utility from regulatory lag were deemed to deprive any protection for ratepayers. There's no statutory remedy, so the court found no implied powers. But the same court in the deferred accounting cases said thereafter doesn't mean thereafter. Cost changes give rise to a new implied contract, which allows the commission to give retroactive remedy. And despite several statutory remedies to ameliorate the effects of regulatory lag, the commission has this implied power to do deferred accounting. It's completely unbalanced as between the utilities and the ratepayers. Let me assure you, this case really isn't about 39 or 41 or the Constitution. This is lawyer language. What these cases are about is the money. What this case is about is who bears the burden of regulatory lag. For every dollar that the utilities get in deferred accounting, or that they are not required to refund in relation back, that's a dollar out of the ratepayer's pocket. Isn't it interesting that the same counsel that says the commission cannot relate back in GTE is the one that says the commission can erase regulatory lag for the electric utilities in deferred accounting? The bottom line is the utilities in this state want the commission and the courts to completely protect them from regulatory lag. They demand as a statutory and constitutional matter complete protection from regulatory lag, while at the same time they insist that the ratepayers should not capture any benefit.
Same question I have for Mr. Barron. If the commission lacked, contrary to at least part of your point of view, the authority to use deferred accounting treatment as it did, if it lacked implied power under the statute to do that, how can we possibly view it as having the implied power to do what you urge us to do in this case?
They are, in fact, two procedurally different remedies. I would urge that the proper result is for this court to affirm what the commission did in GTE and to reverse what the commission did in the deferred accounting cases and send those cases back for the commission to consider whether it should exercise its relation back authority to grant relief to the utilities for the regulatory lag. In that instance, for HLMP, for example, there would only be 3 months of lag. That, of course, also still ignores the 41A issue. And that is just a very difficult issue that I think the court is going to have to address here.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me begin, if I may, with Justice Doggett's inquiry going to the relationship to the two cases, because I think they are very different. Retroactive rate making, as is well acknowledged in the authority, is to take a rate that has been fixed and to retroactively change that rate, precisely what happened here. A rate that had been finally approved, fixed, was retroactively changed over 2 years after the effective date of the rate decision here. Another variation of that is to take a retroactive, I mean, take a rate going back over a period of time and say, we determined retroactively that rate was too high, we order refunds. Deferred accounting is neither of those two things. The deferred accounting items here, the addition of new nuclear plants to the rate base, were never in the rates, never earned on in the rates in any way. Those utilities had existing fixed rates, which were just right, too high, or too low, without consideration of those nuclear plants. The nuclear plants come into the case along with the deferred accounting, and in one sense, it's all deferred accounting. You look back historically to see how much it cost you to build the thing over 5 years or 10 years or however long it took, and then you decide how much you should prudently set into the rate base. Deferred accounting does not involve in any way going back and changing a rate retroactively or ordering refunds or surcharges. And I must say, I think Justice Hightower's question goes to the heart of it. There is no practical way to retroactively impose rate increases in any equitable manner. I respectfully suggest that the commission here is involved in one of those instances where the terrible hydraulic political pressure that sometimes arises from the legislature in relation to administrative agency has led it to, in trying to reach a result in this particular case, espouse an extremely damaging policy. The bedrock of our system is that there's no retroactive rate making. You have fixed and stable rates. And if I might just briefly ask the court, and I won't belabor this, to look at 42. And I respectfully suggest that this isn't a matter of read it any way you choose. It betters the English language to suggest that that does not contemplate prospective rate making. It says these rates shall constitute the legal rate of the public utility until change is provided in this act, shall determine just and reasonable rates to be thereafter observed and enforced. 43 is the same. No question, and if you can't say it any plainer in the English language, we have prospective rate making. If you put to 65, I point in passing to Article 6055, where when a commission, the legislature wishes to provide for reparation or reimbursement of all excess charges retroactively, they do so very clearly. Very clearly. Now, why do we argue? I mean, what are the policy considerations involved in retroactive rate making? And I respectfully suggest that OPUC is misguided if they think that this is a utility issue on retroactive rate making. The commission very appropriately pointed out, you put in retroactive rate making, cuts both ways. And the impacts of it are very high. First, all economists are unanimous that one of the great benefits of no retroactive rate making is that it forces utilities to be efficient. Your rates are fixed. As your costs go up, you don't get to increase your rates. They're fixed until your next rate case. You improve your profitability only by becoming more efficient. Obviously, at your next rate case, the efficiencies you have achieved will be shared with the ratepayers. Secondly, they are critical for investors. An investor looking at a Texas utility with fixed rates in place can look back over a period of 5 years and know what it made. Under what is espoused here, what the commission wants to do to GTE, no investor could look over that five-year period and know what GTE's earnings were. Because, according to OPUC, the commission should be free to retroactively reduce those rates. And
in view of those important public policy considerations, how do we compare with other states then on this issue?
Your Honor, it is, and this is, I believe, set forth at length in the CP&L brief. It remains, even the Krieger article, which OPUC and the commission rely on, say that it remains the fundamental principle that there's no retroactive rate making. You can get into peculiar situations that raise questions, but the fundamental principle remains for rate regulation in this country that we do not go back and retroactively change rates.
The vast majority of states would not permit the PUC then to do what it's trying to do in this case to GTE.
I believe that to be correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Reasoner, the retroactivity, you define it as being from the date of the order. I mean, is the order defined as the final order of the PUC?
It is, Your Honor, and that, but now, and I think this explains the Lone Star case to which they adverted. No one questions that once the commission enters an order and there is an appeal, that this court, or court of appeals, district court certainly has power to make whatever it rules to be go back to the effective date of the commission order. And that's precisely what was involved in the Lone Star case to which reference was made. There, the city of Kaufman had set rates for a gas utility. The appellate jurisdiction of the commission was invoked. The original jurisdiction was invoked in a formal way because there were 75 people living in the Inver suburbs of Kaufman or environs. But standard practice at the Railroad Commission to treat it merely as appellate jurisdiction. The court it clearly recognized that the rate had been set by the city of Kaufman. The appellate decision would relate back to the decision appealed and be held to be erroneous. I do not believe that this court has ever addressed or sanctioned the use of retroactive rate making of the type involved here utilizing the commission's original jurisdiction. Let me point to one other, I think, strong policy consideration that I suspect that the legislature had in mind, and that is we live in an inflationary economy. At the moment, our inflation rates are lower, but as a general proposition, fixed and final rates that are not subject to retroactive adjustment work to the benefit of consumers because in the interim between rate decisions, inflation drives the cost up under what is now being urged upon the court with no finality. Then the utility could come in and say, look, there's 10% inflation in the last 3 years. Go back and adjust our rates retroactively. I respectfully submit that that is an unstable system of regulation with a lack of finality that hurts consumers, utilities, investors, and explains the rationale. But whatever the rationale, our legislature could not have been clearer. I would point to one more very telling point, and that is that the cities, the customers, are not here before this court asking for retroactive rate making. And I quote from the final orders meeting at the commission in 1989, where the city's representative said, "We have consistently urged that rates not be set retroactively, and we don't change our position. We don't think that is good policy." And the cities are sophisticated, and I respectfully submit, precisely correct.
Talking about retroactive, if the utility files a rate case, and it's now in the mill,
yes, Your Honor,
and the PUC sets an interim rate, which I guess it can do if gas charges or fuel charges go up dramatically or something, how are the investors any less confident in their investment during a rate case hearing that's going on just because the PUC might set an interim order setting rates to be observed after that order is set until you get a final hearing? I mean, you're saying that's a retroactive deal, but how does that make them any less sure?
There is no question, Your Honor, that there are statutory exceptions for temporary rates subject to refund. They are a narrow exception. The investor can always be confident, or the consumer, that where you have a fixed and final rate, that up until the time of a subsequent rate case decision, they can rely on that rate. And I believe that I do not think that the commission would claim that there was any express statutory power to do otherwise. Let me say that what went on here First, to put it bluntly, I think the commission is embarrassed. The federal tax laws changed, the gross receipts laws changed, they're being pounded for not having done anything to these utilities. GTE has the misfortune to be before them when two of the commissioners are up for confirmation. So they hammer GTE with this retroactive rate. Now let me come back to Justice Doggett's point about that. And I think Mr. Barron was very circumspect in answering your point about that dilatory finding, because there is absolutely no evidence to support the proposition that GTE was the cause of any dilatory conduct. It was the commission's doing. They delayed this rate case for 3 years while they conducted a statewide case on access charges. If the commission had thought that GTE's rates were excessive, they could have instituted a Section 42 hearing and brought it to conclusion rapidly. There's no lack of statutory remedy here. What went on was GTE being made a scapegoat for the commission being attacked because there was this five-year period. Further, let me say, and this is of vital importance and shows the vice of this kind of conduct, GTE was never allowed to put on evidence, denied the opportunity to put on evidence of what the impact of this out-of-the-blue retroactive setting to 1987 would have occurred. And that $140 million in refunds would have reduced their allowed return of 11% to down to less than half of that. It would have a devastating financial impact on this utility. Because the Court of Appeals rejected retroactive rate making, those issues were never reached, but they remained of vital importance.
Do I understand that in its next or current rate making proceeding, GTE should be accorded deferred accounting treatment even if it had a $140 million overcharge?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor.
Well, let's assume that you're right and the state cannot go back and recapture the $140 million. If I understand the argument you've advanced this morning, GTE should still be able to get deferred accounting treatment, and we ought not to consider whether it had $140 million in overcharges or not.
Well, you've been speaking.
I'm mixing the two cases.
Speaking.
I'm mixing the two cases. I understand that's not an issue today, but I'm trying to understand your argument on how these two intertwine.
If there were a utility that had over-earned in the amount of $140 million, but that utility is not GTE, Your Honor, the examiner expressly found that their costs had been declining and that you could not retroactively set a just and reasonable rate at the same level.
Let me pose the question that way then. Let's assume that there were a utility somewhere that the state determined had overcharged $140 million, and this court determined there could be no retroactive rate making for the very policy reasons you've advanced this morning. Would that utility of necessity, under the arguments you've advanced, be assured of getting deferred accounting treatment?
I appreciate your indulgence on the distinction, Your Honor, of some importance to my client. I think I would answer that question as Your Honor expects.
Right.
I would answer it yes. That is right. We do not, when we consider the addition of a new plant to the rate base, we don't look backwards and say, guess what, we're going to wipe out so much of the cost of the new plant because we've retroactively decided you earned too much money. Now, it certainly is true that when you put the new plant in, if that utility were over-earning, you might get, even with the addition of a new plant to the total rate base, you might have the overall rates reduced. You can conduct a rate base. Commission has full power to deal with over-earnings. They just can't do it in this fashion, and the commission itself concedes that.
In fact, in the beginning of the nuclear age, that was what everybody thought was going to happen, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. It was
when,
going to be
when they began to sell these nuclear plants. Why there was the thought that, well, once we get to producing this very cheap power, then everybody's rates are going to go way down.
Yeah, that's right, Your Honor. Responsible scientists claimed that nuclear power was going to be too cheap to meter. But
let me ask another question.
Work out that
that's
way.
Not about this case, as long as we're on that. you essentially have made the proposition that any time there's new capital investment, you ought to be able to seek deferred accounting for that.
where do you get that limit that is new plant? If not in the statute, why couldn't you say we have to overhaul our old coal-fired plant and it's dramatically expensive? I mean, where are we ever going to draw the line? You're able to draw a very nice clean line, no retroactive
yes.
rate making ever.
Yes.
How do you draw such a clean line in your argument on the
well, part of I respectfully submit that this court should not attempt to draw such a clean line. It is that the legislature...
It has been suggested here. I mean, clean lines have been suggested. Financial
well,
integrity of the utility.
Only clean lines are presented here. But in it, because you're dealing with large new plant additions. But I think that the statute in Section 27 delegates to the commission considerable discretion as to where to draw the line on to permit deferred accounting. I mean, obviously a new window unit air conditioner, you're not going to use deferred accounting. A new nuclear plant, you're going to use deferred accounting. I don't think the court is presented with any very difficult issues here on where to draw
maybe
the line.
We don't want to take all this. I had to think of a principled articulation, and you essentially say leave it to the PUC unless we disagree with their call.
I think when the commission is following its statute, that is correct. When they are within the ambit, I would understand that to be the import of your jurisprudence, rather, that great deference has been delegated to them in these highly specialized areas. I would say in passing two things. One, we believe that if the evidence were ever to come out on GTE, this wouldn't have occurred. We believe that's one reason we were not permitted to show the impact. Further, we would suggest that there would be an issue of constitutional dimensions if this could be done to us in this fashion. But let me turn very briefly, if I may, to issues of great importance, and that is the tax issues. We believe that the Court of Appeals, misreading Justice Gonzalez's decision in Houston Lighting and Power, grossly misconstrued the tax treatment here, or required a gross misconstruction of it, in a way that makes us aberrational and stand out among the other states. If you would put up 41C or 2, please. The PUC is asked to deal with consolidated returns where there are savings, et cetera, to be sure that the utility gets a fair share. We believe the Court of Appeals misconstrued this, said, no, you can't do that. You can't give them a fair share. We read this court's decision, the Supreme Court's decision, in the Houston Lighting and Power case, to simply negate that and say it's only actual taxes paid incurred. I would respectfully submit that the court did not address this statute, did not address this question, and both the commission with whom we are in complete agreement on this, and have briefed it extensively, and if you'd show the other one. Again, on disallowed expenses which the ratepayer will never bear, the Court of Appeals said you've got to take the rate reductions from those and give them to the the tax reductions from those and give them to the ratepayer even though they have nothing to do with them. In the 42 jurisdictions and the 41 other jurisdictions where GTE operates, they don't do it that way. We can find no jurisdiction that argues that as a principal basis you can take non-utility expenses for which the ratepayer is not at risk, bears no burden, take the tax benefit and take it away from the utility. Obviously, that it is not sensible use of rate-making power. I mean, it's clearly an arbitrary seizure of benefits, if you were to show this last chart. And this, I believe that the court has received 12 amicus briefs on this. I would respectfully urge the court to clarify the law in this area because this is constantly arises in utility regulation, what the tax treatment is.
Wasn't this issue at the core of the debate over the reenactment of the Public Utility Regulatory Act before the recent session of the legislature?
There was, Your Honor, and I confess I was not involved in that. I'm not deeply familiar with it. As I understand it, there was an effort to get legislation which would
solve
this problem from the utility standpoint.
It did not pass.
It did not pass. I do not, if I am correct, Your Honor, it would not be appropriate to draw any inference from that other than they were trying to take two bites at the apple. I believe that it was that effort was made necessary only by the Court of Appeals' misconstruction of the tax law and was not necessary. I believe the existing law makes clear you cannot properly do, and I'll just, if I might, Your Honor, just briefly point to this chart, you can see that the PUC, in doing a fair allocation, came down to under $20 million. Under the Court of Appeals, if it were applied literally by the PUC, GTE would go negative on tax expense. And our statute, by its plain language, does not contemplate such a result. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Very briefly, the issue of political pressure, dilatory tactics, is an issue that the district court did not reach because it ruled on the question of statutory interpretation.
And so that remains to be determined?
It remains to be determined by the district court. It did not need to reach that issue. GTE in its brief has suggested that it would be perfectly appropriate for the district court to be able to reach those issues. We concur. We do not think that that issue ought to be before the court at this time. The core issue ought to be, does the commission have the statutory discretion to act as it did, and are there constitutional constraints? And if the court agrees, it should say so, and then reverse and not render, but remand for further proceedings to the district court. On the statutory construction issue, you were pointing to Article 6055. That provision, which is a provision administered by the Railroad Commission, is not on point and is not an illustration of when the legislature may specifically authorize retroactive rates pursuant to setting an effective date. That provision goes to a situation, as shown in the Moran case decided by this court, when a utility often decides it's not going to charge the rates prescribed in an order and it's charged an illegal rate and has to make a refund. That's what that goes to. So the statutory construction issue goes right back Sections 42 and 43 in light of the broad delegation of statutory authority. Mr. Reasoner said, couched what the commission is doing in terms of a, guess what, we're going to go back and pull away earnings that you were entitled to without giving fair notice, thereby impairing the efficiency and ability of a utility to operate, destroying reasonable expectations. The commission, in finding fact 10, specifically looked at whether during the regulatory lag period that it was reducing from 1989 back to 1987, whether the utility was given an opportunity to earn, cover its reasonable expenses, and earn a return. And the commission looked at the whole record and made that determination that indeed it was a just and reasonable rate during that regulatory lag period.
But less than what an investor in 1987 would have expected to earn.
Your Honor, the Commission's position is that what an investor ought to have concluded in 1984, when this case was first filed, is that GTE's existing rates at that time were subject to change, that the General Counsel had filed an answer making this a Section 42's case, saying that it had good reason to think that the current existing rates were excessive and not just and reasonable. And that notice was reiterated in the second order of remand on October 27, 1987, by the Commission, when it said that we are going to take a hard look and see whether there should be appropriate over-recoveries in light of the costs overall. And
but if the rule is that investors beware, the PUC may always go back and reduce rates that were too high for a back period of time, wouldn't it have the problems Mr. Reasoner argues?
I don't think the problem would be totally eliminated, but I would ask the court to consider that the effect is going to be no different than if the commission at the outset sets temporary rates, because there's always going to be the uncertainty about what will happen, and the same is true for bonded rates. When the utility comes in after the suspension period and implements its own unilateral rates, the statute says these rates are subject to refund. There is an uncertainty But it's not as if all retroactive rate making is impermissible and for that reason. And this court recognized that in the Lone Star case. And the prospect of refunds over recoveries for temporary rates at the end of the case, bonded rates, reverse and remand, their surcharges or bill credits may have to go out, are all instances in which there is an element of uncertainty.
But some retroactive rate making ought not to be permitted, the PUC agrees with.
Absolutely. In the ordinary
case. How do you draw the line between them?
The commission has to make the judgment when there has been an extraordinary amount of regulatory lag, consider all the factors, and exercise its discretion to be reviewed under an abusive discretion standard, hopefully by the district court on reverse and remand.
Any other questions for Mr. Barron? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Reasoner addressed the tax issue. And let me indicate to the court that was not one of the issues that were assigned for oral arguments. And because of that, the petitioners structured the argument the way that they did and the council that were to argue. The Office of Public Utility Council and the cities, both of whom were vitally interested in the income tax issue, did not prepare oral argument on it, thinking that it would not be addressed. They would like to reserve their right to file a post-hearing letter response.
You may do so. Whether or not we grant a point of error, the whole case is before us.
We understand that.
So we'd be happy to receive any further briefing you might have.
When we discuss retroactivity, it's important to distinguish what it is that is retroactive. In the deferred accounting cases and in GTE, there was no attempt to go back and recalculate the rates that would have actually been charged to individual customers during the period in question. There was an attempt to identify an amount which was owed to one side or the other as a result of the lag. The relief was all prospective. In the deferred accounting cases, it's bundled up into the general revenue requirement. But in essence, it is a surcharge. In GTE, it is a separate item on the bill, but it's a credit to the bill. And the individual customers are not credited back for their usage during that period. So we need to be careful what we talk about when we discuss retroactive rate making. There is a retroactive effect, but not down to the level of an individual customer basis. The relief in both cases was indeed prospective in nature, but designed to address retroactive problems. In the deferred accounting case, utilities are saying rates were too low during this period. They were set not recognizing this immense cost increase that came about when our plant went into service. So identify the amount, defer it, and we want to recover it prospectively from the end of the next rate case. In GTE, we're saying rates were too high. The last time rates were set, they did not take account of this large change in the tax laws. And so, prospectively, take back from the company the amount of the over-recovery for this single cost item that was not calculated in rates then in effect. This is the same thing.
But some of that could have been alleviated here by filing a rate reduction case.
Let me address that. First of all, there was an attempt to establish interim rates. The commission did order that there be a temporary rate hearing. GTE went to the courthouse. We tried a temporary injunction hearing. And Judge Hart indicated that a temporary injunction would issue. When we got back to the commission issued its second order of remand, saying, go forward, GTE, you're on notice. When we get finished with this case, we're going to think about relating back the effective date, as we're allowed to do under Lone Star. Second, there were temporary rates set in January May. And third, during about this same time period, the Office of Public Utility Counsel had filed a Section 42 case against not only GTE, but all of the utilities in the state, including the electric utilities that were before you this morning. It lay fallow at the PUC for a couple of years and was finally dismissed without being prosecuted. Consumers of the state were not allowed to show that as a result of income tax reductions and gross receipts tax reductions on the state side, utilities were over-earned. So there were attempts to establish interim rates. We were just frustrated at every turn, either by the courts or the commission. Retroactive rate making happens all the time. Let's not fool ourselves. Yes, it is an evil to be avoided when possible, but it happens all the time. The statute requires it. interim and bonded rates. The statute requires retroactive rate making in a relatively new proceeding where if the commission does not act in time, telephone utilities' proposed rates are deemed effective as of an earlier date. This court has approved, at least without reversing, a court of appeals decision which says we engage in retroactive rate making after we find error in a commission order. In fact, what is going to happen in all of these cases before you today if the court does nothing and affirms in their entirety all the Court of Appeals decisions? We're going to go back to the PUC and we're going to engage in retroactive rate making. The rule that we are trying to express to the court is one of balance. In accordance with PURA Section 2, it requires a balancing of interest between utilities and their customers. All we are saying is retroactive rate making is an evil to be avoided when possible, but when it is necessary and appropriate, you must give only that relief which is possible given the Commission's jurisdiction. In GTE, that means it can do what it did. It related back the effective date. In the deferred accounting cases, it cannot do what it did because they were not total revenue requirements reviewed, and they granted relief for a period over which the Commission did not have rate-making jurisdiction.
Any questions? Thank you, Council. That concludes the argument in this clause. All of the foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. Court's oral submission docket is concluded for the day, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.